the first time, Robert had a feeling of desperation. Events were beginning to pile up into a tremendous climax, and he had nothing to contribute. Ramsden grew more and more monosyllabic on the telephone. Baffled was a word that had not until now had even the remotest connection with Alex Ramsden. So Ramsden was monosyllabic and sore. The one bright spot occurred when Robert went out to the franchise on the Thursday afternoon of that week. "Something unexpected has happened," Marion said. "My watch has come back."
"You mean you found it?"
"No. Rose Glynn has sent it back through the post." She produced a small, very dirty, white cardboard box, which contained her watch with the blue enamel face. And on a torn piece of paper was printed, "I don't want none of it." "Why do you think Rose Glynn turned squeamish about it?" Marion wondered.
"I don't for a moment think she did," Robert said.
"But she sent it back."
"Someone sent it back. Someone who was frightened. Someone with a rudimentary conscience, too. If Rose Glynn had wanted to be rid of it, she would have thrown it into a pond without a second thought. But X wants to be rid of it, and to make restitution at the same time. X has a bad conscience now. Who would have a bad conscience about you just now? Gladys Reese?"
"Yes, of course. You think perhaps Rose Glynn gave my watch to Gladys Reese?"
"Yes, and that might explain a lot. It might explain how Rose got her to back up that screaming story, if she had been the receiver of stolen goods. Yes, I think it was Gladys who sent back your watch. If ever there was an unwilling witness, it was Gladys. And if Gladys is shakable to the point of sending back your property, a faint hope begins to dawn."
"But she has committed perjury,"
Mrs. Sharp said.
"Yes, but she could plead she was blackmailed into it. If someone suggested that course to her." Mrs. Sharp eyed him.
"Isn't there anything in English law about tampering with a witness?"
"Plenty, but I don't propose to do any tampering."
"What do you propose to do?"
"I must think it over. If we could knock the prop of Gladys Reese from under Rose's story, it would undermine their whole case. It's their most valuable piece of evidence that Rose had mentioned hearing screaming in your attic before there was any suggestion of a charge against you. I suppose you couldn't see Inspector Grant's face when Rose was giving evidence in court. A fastidious mind must be a great handicap in the CID. Now I must be getting back. May I take the little cardboard box and the scrap of paper with the printing?" Robert drove back to Milford with his mind full of this new development. It was no solution, but it might be a lifeline. In his office he found Mr. Ramsden waiting for him, long, grey, lean, and dour as ever. "Mr. Blair," he said, "we're wasting your money. That is what it amounts to."
"Do I understand you are giving up?"
"I don't put it like that exactly, but it isn't a business proposition, Mr. Blair. It isn't even a good gamble." Robert fished the little cardboard box out of his pocket. "Well, I have something for your consideration. One of the witnesses in court on Monday was a girl called Gladys Reese. Her role was to supply evidence that her friend, Rose Glynn, had talked to her about hearing screams from the attic at the franchise long before the police were interested. She supplied the evidence all right, but she was nervous and unwilling. Then this morning, the watch that Rose stole from Miss Sharp came back by post in this box, with the printed message enclosed. Rose would never have bothered to return the watch. It's obvious that she has no conscience at all, so the conclusion is inescapable. It was Gladys who received the watch from Rose, and that was how Rose got her to back up her lies." Ramsden merely nodded, but it was an interested nod. "Now, we can't approach Gladys," Robert continued, "without being accused of intimidating witnesses. But what I want to do is to be able to put this printed scrap into court as evidence, to be able to say that it is Gladys Reese's writing, and thus make the suggestion that Rose used pressure on her to testify to what isn't true. Kevin McDermott will then assure her that if she was blackmailed into giving false evidence, she will probably not be punished for it." And she breaks down and confesses.
"So you want another specimen of Gladys Reese's printing?"
"Yes. It can't be very long since she left school. Perhaps her school could furnish one." Or anyhow, provide a starting off place. When Alec Ramsden walked into Robert's office next morning, he was both pleased and amused.
I better confess frankly, Mr. Blair, that when you put me onto that idea of the school, I had no great hopes.
But you had the right idea, after all.
You mean you've got what we wanted?
Yes. I saw a Miss Bagley, who was Gladys Reese's form mistress, and I was quite frank about what we wanted and why. Well, she said to give it a minute to think. Then she said, of course, she was very good at drawing, and we like to keep good work when our pupils produce it, and she hunted through some things and produced this. It appeared to be a map of Canada. Across the bottom was printed in block letters, Dominion of Canada. And in the right-hand corner was the signature, Gladys Reese.
Marvellous, Robert said.
Now, we need a handwriting expert. Who is the best man at this sort of thing? Ramsden told him, and added, I'll take it up to town with me now, tonight, and have his report before morning. Then I'll take it round to Mr. McDermott. Perfect, Robert said. It's a terrific load off my mind, but the real load is still there. Proving that Rose Glynn is a thief, liar, and blackmailer with perjury thrown in as a sideline leaves Betty Kane's story still untouched. And it is Betty Kane's story that we set out to disprove.
There's still time, Ramsden said.
Robert shook his head.
About all there is time for is a miracle.
It was when the assizes were only 4 days away that Robert confessed this to Aunt Lynn. She listened in surprised silence, her jewel blue eyes attentive and concerned.
We need your prayers, Aunt Lynn. Nothing short of a miracle can save us now, he reiterated.
Well, I shall pray for a miracle.
A last-minute reprieve with the rope round the hero's neck? That only happens in detective stories.
Aunt Lynn shook her head.
Not at all. It happens every day.
You haven't enough faith, dear, as I've pointed out before.
I don't believe that an angel of the Lord is going to appear in my office with an account of what Betty Kane was doing for that month, if that's what you mean.
The trouble with you, dear, said Aunt Lynn, is that you think of an angel of the Lord as a creature with wings, whereas he is probably a scrappy little man in a bowler hat. As it turned out, the angel of the Lord wasn't a scruffy little man in a bowler hat, but he arrived at Blair, Haywood and Bennett's the following morning.
Mr. Robert, old Mr. Heseltine said, there's a Mr. Langer in the office to see you.
Robert, who was busy and not expecting angels of the Lord, said, find out tactfully what he wants, will you? If it's nothing important, Neville can deal with it.
Mr. Heseltine frowned.
His pronunciation of English isn't very good.
The man's a foreigner?
Yes, he comes from Copenhagen.
Copenhagen? Why didn't you tell me that before? Show him in. Oh, merciful heaven, do fairy tales come true?
Mr. Langer's face shone with friendly rectitude.
Mr. Blair, I apologize for bothering you, but it was important. Important to you, I mean.
Sit down, Mr. Langer.
Thank you. It is warm, is it not? He smiled. This is perhaps the day you have your summer?
Yes, Robert said encouragingly.
I keep an hotel in Copenhagen, Mr. Blair. The Hotel of the Red Shoes, it is called. And to study English is my hobby.
Hobby, Robert said involuntarily.
Hobby? Oh, thank you. For a hobby, I study the idiomatic English. So every day, the newspapers they leave about are brought to me.
They?
The English visitors.
Ah, yes.
In the evening, when they have retired, the page collects the English papers and leaves them in my office. They go into a pile, and when I have leisure, I pick up one and study it.
Do I make myself clear, Mr. Blair?
Perfectly, Mr. Langer.
So it goes on, and then one day I take this paper from the pile, and I forget all about the idiom.
Mr. Langer took from his pocket a folded copy of the Ack Emma and spread it in front of Robert on the desk. It was the issue of Friday, May 10th, with the photograph of Betty Kane occupying 2/3 of the front page.
I look at this photograph, he said. Then I read the story. Then I say to myself, this is most extraordinary. The papers say this is a photograph of Betty Kane. Betty Kane. But it is also the photograph of Mrs. Chadwick, who stayed at my hotel with her husband.
What?
Mr. Langer looked pleased. You're interested? Go on. Tell me. A fortnight they stayed with me, and it was most extraordinary, Mr. Blair, because while that poor girl was being beaten and starved in an English attic, Mrs. Chadwick was enjoying herself very much. So, when I am coming to England on business, I put the newspaper into my bag and show it to my friend, where I am staying. And my friend is instantly very excited and say, but it is now a police affair, and these women have been arrested for what they are supposed to have done to this girl, and they are about to be tried for it. And he calls to his wife, where is the paper of a week last Tuesday? It is the kind of house where there is always a paper of a week last Tuesday, and he shows me the account of the trial, court appearance. Yes, and I read how the trial is to be in a little more than a fortnight, and my friends say, here in the paper is the name of a solicitor for the women, and you will go down to this Milford and tell what you think to this Mr. Blair. So, here I am.
Robert sat back. Do you believe in miracles, Mr. Langer? You have saved our bacon.
A bacon?
An English idiom. For your collection. The girl's husband, what did he look like?
Young, dark, good-looking, a little flashy, I think.
Was he on holiday?
No, he was in Copenhagen on business.
What kind of business?
That I do not know, I regret.
What was his address?
London.
Beautifully explicit. Robert said. And now, Mr. Langer, let us go over to the Rose and Crown and have some bad English beer.